Good afternoon. So last time we talked more about signals. We mentioned that signals were kind of this analog of exceptions, but instead of being something for the OS, which exceptions are, they're something for programs. And instead of being implemented by the hardware, like exceptions are, they're implemented by the OS. And one of the most common sort of use cases for signals is they're the mechanism that Unix, like OS, is used to forward many hardware exceptions to your program and let your program decide what to do about them. And how you do that is you can register a signal handler, some function that the OS will call when this event happens. We also talked a bit about logistics of signal handlers. We mentioned this idea of signal unsafety, that there's a problem here that signal handlers can run whenever the signal is triggered, and that can be sort of random times. And most code is not written to have other code run in the middle of it if they are using the same data structure. So we saw, for example, that technically, you know, if we're calling printf in our signal handler, we are in trouble if our signal handler is running in the middle of another call to printf, because printf isn't guaranteed to be written to handle that situation. It's understandable why. It's like, it's actually really hard to write functions to handle being called in the middle of themselves when they're not supposed to be recursive. It's not something we're used to doing. Then we moved on to our next topic, which is about sort of security stuff. And we mentioned these sort of two security things we expect operating systems to kind of implement for us. And one of them is this idea of authentication, that when I'm using a shared machine, that I somehow have to verify that I'm me and not someone else. And another part of this is authorization, that given that we know who logged into the machine, we have to restrict what, you know, programs that are running on behalf of that person can do to whatever our policy says is the right thing. And kind of the main mechanism we see used for this is tracking what we'll call user IDs. So we'll have, each program will have a user ID, and this will be part of the information tracked by the program, like the process ID and other things the OS needs to run the program. And on sort of the Unix design, this is separate from usernames. We learned that the actual usernames and passwords are actually handled by kind of programs installed by the system administrator. They're not part of the kernel code. They aren't something system call handlers know about. And we'll talk more about that later today. So questions about things we covered last time? So I'd like to talk briefly about the lab. So one thing is some common issues that came up in the lab that might be worth talking about briefly. So one thing is a lot of people like using scanf to read numbers. And that's fine, but using scanf for line-based input is kind of tricky. My preference would be to use fgetS and then use scanf, which is the scanf from a string instead of standard in. And the reason why is that a lot of people ran into this problem here, where they'd ask for the PID and the user would input 1234 enter. You scanf with %d and it reads the 1234 and leaves the new line not read, because we didn't ask it to read a new line, you asked it to read a number. Read the number, it's done. And this meant that when you called fgetS after this, fgetS said, oh, there's a new line here. I got you first line, it's empty. And this caused a lot of people to send sync user one before it was ready to the other program, and things crashed. Another common sort of category of problems were people mixing up the file names of the shared memory region. So we had a file that was the memory we were sharing with the other program to send messages in one direction, and the contents of that you get from mmap. And I think the most common reason for this is that people just decided to call them both inbox, so they didn't remember which was which, or outbox, But same problem. They didn't remember which was which. And you know, you can't use the file name to access the contents of the file or vice versa. Another category of problems I notice, especially in grading submitted things, is a lot of people tried to do cleanup work and they like cleaned up the files, but their program would hang. And usually the reason why is they had a handler for SIGINT or SIGTERM that like did the cleanup work and then returned. And the problem is that the reason why when you type control C your program usually exits is that the default handler makes your program exit. When you replace that handler, your program no longer exits on control C. And same thing for SIGTERM, when you replace that, killing your program no longer makes it exit. So you need to have some sort of exit in your handler in addition to doing the cleanup. Yes?
Why
were people having SIG user 1 getting sent in the first case? So often they'd have code where after they read in the PID of the other program, they'd read in the first line, fill the out box, and then send SIG user 1. And because that read of the first line would happen right away, they would send it before they did anything with the other program. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So in my SIG term, I have it handled so that when the SIG term appears, it will send SIG into the other process. But then it does exit, but then it shows that it prints out that is a segmentation fault. Is that a...
So the question is, you experienced a case where you tried to send SIG term to the other process, and you ended up with a segmentation fault?
But
it still exits. So we gave credit. I wasn't picky for grading, and I'm probably going to try to have TAs adjust partial checkoffs a little bit. If you had cleanup code, but it didn't like exit cleanly, but that is not what we intended you to do. My guess as to what was happening is that you had some like null pointer to reference if your cleanup code like ended up running twice or something like that, which might have happened because like you were sending, maybe the other process sent a signal back or something. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? And briefly talking about anonymous feedback. So after I talked about people saying the class was going too fast, some people said it goes slow, I assume the answer is somewhere in the middle, and I have no idea where. And people say that I'm slowing down because of questions. Yes, I am. And my usual default assumption, which may or may not be correct, is that usually more people have questions than are asking them, but I know like it varies, right? Sometimes one person asking a question means like 50 people have the same question and aren't asking it, and sometimes one person asking a question means that only they care about that, and it's hard to tell. And then there's some feedback about the signal lab being difficult. So one thing is people saying, oh, I had a bug that took a lot of TAs to figure out. So something which disturbs me here is that my hope is that students are debugging, not TAs. And especially because if the way TAs are debugging is by staring at your code, that's not a good way to debug. You know, that's not how I figure out if something's wrong. I like, have to test things, and that's what should be happening. And it should be TAs guiding you to do things to your program or do things in the debugger to debug your code, not like trying to stare at it and figure out what's wrong. There probably is something about debugging procedures we could provide better guidance on, but I probably need to think about what that is. I also understand that there were debugging labs in CSO1, and the impression of people who've taught CSO1 is that maybe students don't remember them very well in CSO1, let alone CSO2 later on. So that might be a thing. And also probably you saw this list of common problems. I think just pointing these out in the assignment will probably help things a lot in future semesters with respect to debugging efforts or having them known by the TAs rather than TAs needing to figure out that this first scenario is what's going on, which, yes, takes a lot of fiddling to notice. Also, some anonymous feedback asking for an extension. I generally, if an assignment's too hard, I usually don't want to like make it worse by making you spend more time on it. And we have a late policy, so please take advantage of the late policy. Notably, if you submit your C file, you can submit it 48 hours late, so Friday, Saturday morning for 90% credit, and 72 hours late for 80% credit. So, like, if you really didn't finish things, take advantage of that. Okay. So, questions on anonymous feedback and signals lab? Yes.
Yeah, I just had a question. So, like, I got like some sort of like partial credit for the lab, like from a TA. If I were to like go back and submit.
So the question is, what happens if you submit and you also have a checkoff? We should give you the maximum of the two grades. If that doesn't happen, let me know. Other questions? Okay, so last time when we finished up, we talked about user ID. So we mentioned on Unix-like systems, we have this function called getEUID, which gets the effective user ID of our program. And every program has one of these associated, and that ID sort of specifies who's running the program is usually how we think of it. It doesn't have to be used that way, right? Because this is just a number that's going to be compared against other numbers. But the typical use is that we have a user ID specifies who's running the program. That's kind of the intended use. And we'll talk about how that ID is used in a bit. And usually you think of usernames. So there's a bunch of standard libraries and programs that maintain a mapping from numbers to names. So when you like log in and type your username and not your user ID, with, you know, you type a name, not a number, the way that works is that there's some database somewhere that stores the this name is this ID. On single user systems, traditionally it's a file slash etsy password. And on sort of the department machines, because we have like a shared database across multiple machines, is actually like retrieved over the network. So in addition to user IDs, Unix-like systems support groups. So which are meant to represent collections of users. They don't have to map it that way. And every process has an effective group ID, which you can get with getEGID, and it also can have some additional group IDs, because you can be in multiple groups. And these IDs, again, are just numbers. There's a name for each of them, but that's managed entirely outside the kernel, so these sort of map to system calls. The system calls don't know anything about the names. That's done entirely in sort of programs like that handle logging in, things like that. Yes?
So the kernel doesn't store the group ID at all?
So the question is, so the kernel doesn't store the group ID at all? No, the kernel stores the ID, the number, but it doesn't know anything about what the number means as far as a name. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Are numbers kept separate from usernames for security reasons?
Like, are the group ID numbers separate from the user ID numbers? Is your question?
Question is why
did I say that we have this mapping maintained outside the kernel? Why don't system calls handle that? And you're asking if that's for security reasons. So I don't think it's a security reasons thing. I think it's just a keeping the kernel code simpler thing. Right? Now we don't have to have all this string handling in the kernel. We just handle numbers. That's a lot easier. Other questions? Yeah. What is a group? So a group is kind of represents a collection of users. As we'll see, when we're asking whether you can access a file, we're going to check, does your user ID let you access it? And do each of your group IDs let you access it? If any of them is yes, you'll probably be able to access the file. Well, you'll be able to access the file possibly. We'll talk about precedence rules in a bit, but basically this is sort of another way you can be given access to something is by being in the right group in addition to being the right user. Yes?
What does effective mean?
So There are other types of group IDs which aren't the one that is currently being used to check permissions. So these ones are used to actually check, can you access a file? There's some other group IDs which are used to track, like, if we're running a program that gets to run as a different group, what group was it previously? Does that answer your question?
Yep.
Okay. Other questions? So if I run on, say, a department machine here, I run this command called ID, and it displays my current list of user and group IDs. So you can see my user ID is 858182, and this program helpfully looked it up in the database and found that that's CR4BD. And my primary, my effective group ID is 21, which it looked up is named CS Faculty. And I'm also in some other groups, this instructors group and this 4414 group, and they all have their own group IDs. So my program that's running has all these IDs stored by the kernel as part of the process. So the kernel knows when I make an open call that I have this user ID, I have all these group IDs. And it's going to use that information to decide, am I allowed to do this open or other operation? Some questions so far? Okay, so as I've presented group IDs, it seems like this is kind of just redundant to user IDs, like user IDs give us the same information. Now, they don't have to be used that way. So for example, one idea you might have is you might make a group called video, which gives you access to the monitor. And when a user logs in, you'll make their programs be part of that group when they're logging in front of the machine in person, and if they're logging in remotely, you won't make them part of that group. And in this way, we can use groups to represent, you know, things that are not actually attached to the user. At least this is conceptually possible. In practice, this doesn't work very well because, you know, I can like have a program stay running in the background and it will still be part of the video group unless something is working very hard to undo that. So this doesn't really work in practice, but that's kind of one of the theories behind why the groups are separate from the users, is that theoretically you can kind of partition, you can give people temporary access to things with them. Yeah?
Why isn't it like stored the other way around? Like the user can access to these groups.
Why isn't it stored that the other way around? So there's a program, as we'll talk later, that assigns the groups when you log in, probably. For that program, the information is stored that way. There's a list of this user gets assigned these groups. When we're running programs, we just track the current groups. We don't actually do lookups on the fly. We just they were determined when you logged in, basically, and we're just going to keep track of what they were when you logged in, unless something, you know, gives you additional groups or takes them away. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we talked about these users and groups, and one of the sort of primary things we do with this is have a way of restricting access to files. So POSIX, standard Unix, has this very restricted thing we could call an access control list, a special case of an access control list. It's a list of who can access a file, so it controls the access to a file. And we're going to talk about this very restricted form and a very flexible form. But the restricted form has sort of a fixed set of fields. It has one user ID that's associated with the file, and this user ID is called the owner of the file. And this user ID is allowed to change these permissions. So that's a special thing you get for being that user ID. So if you ask to change the permissions of a file, the operating system is going to check, are you running as the same user ID that's the owner? There's also some bits indicating that for the owner, are they allowed to read the file, write the file, or execute the file? So if you ask to open a file and you're the owner, the operating system's going to check for this read bit associated with the file to see, are you allowed to read it? If you're opening for writing, it will also check for the write bit. If you're trying to execute a file, it will check for the execute bit. And if you don't have these, that system call will fail. Now, if you're the owner of the file and the system call failed, well, you could fix that by changing these permissions with a different system call. But will still be enforced. You know, open will still fail until you change that. Yes? How is read and execute different? So read is things like open for reading, and execute is like run in the shell. And on directories, as we mentioned down here, we have an execute bit, but it means something different. It means search the directory. So if a directory is marked readable, you can ls it. If it's marked execute, you can access files in it, but you can't ls it. Yes?
Is the owner the same thing as like the root?
Is the owner the same thing as root? No. So typically when you create a file, you are the owner of the file. And I guess I should say, as the owner, the permissions you can change are these ones, not the user and group ID. Does that answer your question? Okay. So files can also have an associated group ID, and with which is going to be sort of one group ID. And with that, we can allow processes that are running in that group to read, write, or execute the file. We can turn each of those on and off separately. So I can make a file that's owned by me. It has the group CS faculty. And I can let faculty read and write the file, but not other people by default. Yes?
So could the file creator themselves cancel their own permissions?
Question, can the file creator themselves cancel their own permissions? Absolutely, except that the owner always has the ability to change all these permission bits. So they can always undo that cancellation. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is, if I run sort of Python foo, does this require execute permission on foo? The answer is no. So execute permission only applies when you're running that file directly. Other questions? Okay, and so we mentioned that you can set like whether people in a particular group can read, write, or execute the file. And we can also set a default setting. And that's if someone doesn't match the user, doesn't match the group, what do we allow them to? And we can set, can they read the file? Can they write the file? Can they execute the file? So this is sort of the standard Unix permissions that are supported. You might think this is, you know, it's useful, but it's not flexible in certain ways. So one thing is that if I want to share a file with someone, the way I have to do that is we better have a group in common, and there better be the case that no one who I don't want to access the file that way is part of that group. Because all I can do is make the group be able to access the file in addition to me in certain ways or not. It's kind of unflexible, but it can be enough, at least if you can create new groups for everything you need to share files for. So, we have these bits. Let's talk about sort of how they're represented, because this comes up in some commands. So these permissions are encoded traditionally as a 9-bit number, because we have 3 bits for the user, the owner of the file, 3 bits for the group the file is assigned to, and 3 bits for everyone else. And these are traditionally written as a 3-digit octal number, 3 octal digits, because octal is base 8. Have 3 bits there. And each part we're going to have read, write, and execute represented as the 4s, 2s, and 1s place respectively. So this means, for example, 700 is the user, the owner can read and write and execute, group can do none of those things, and others can do none of those things. or 451 is the user can read, the group can read or execute, and others can execute. This is and questions about this? Yes.
So other would be people who are not the owner and are not in any of the groups as well?
So question, are there going to be people who are not the owner and not in any of the groups? Yes, and those are handled by the other permissions. So this default case handles that last octal digit handles that case. Does that answer your question? Yes. Where do I encode what group? That is set separately. There is a command, which usually you won't have permission to run, called chgroup, which will change the group assigned to a file. Yes?
If you give more permission to others than a group, would that group get the same permissions as others?
If you give more permission to others than the groups, would that group have less permissions? That's my understanding of how it's supposed to work, but I haven't tested that. Yes?
Sorry, what exactly could go into the others category?
What goes into others? If you don't match the user and you don't match the group, the operating system will use the others category. Okay. Other questions? Question, does the user hold precedence over everything else? What do you mean by precedence?
Like, let's check first.
The user, question, should the user's permissions be checked first? Yes. That's my understanding. So if you match the user ID, we'll use the user permissions, not the group or other ones. Yes? So question, if a user is part of the group for the 451 example, should it be able to read and execute or just read? My understanding is just read. Of course, they can change the permissions, so they can update it to be 551. So that's kind of a soft restriction, because they can always edit the file to undo, to change these settings. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Question, so if you have permissions to execute a file, but it's inside a directory you don't have permissions for, will you be able to run it? My understanding is no, but search permission on the directory should be enough to run it, is my understanding. I'm not sure if that's actually true all the time, because people do not try to take advantage of this sort of thing very often. Other questions? Okay. So we have this encoding, and you can use this with a command you may have seen before, chmod, for change mode. These are called the mode bits of the file. There's also a few non-permission-based mode bits, that one of which we'll talk about later. And chmod also supports a syntax you might find more intuitive, where you can specify, rather than with a number, you can specify user gets read, write, and execute, other and group get nothing, or users get read, groups get write and execute, others get nothing. You can just specify it in that kind of way, which you might find more intuitive. At least with the Linux chmod, some other OSs might not be so flexible. Yes? Question, can those things be in any order? That is my understanding. Yes, other questions? Yeah. For the second example, it says others get no access. Yes, this should be an X here. I am sorry about that. To be actually equivalent. Other questions? And one of the more notable things about this syntax is that You can also use it to adjust permissions rather than setting them all at once. So for example, if you run this command chmod u plus rx, it will add read and execute permissions for the user, but leave all the other settings unchanged. Whatever they were, they'll stay that way. So if group had read permissions before, they still will. If they didn't before, they still won't. Or similarly, you can do like here, you can make other not have read, write, or execute permission and give users read and execute and leave the group settings unchanged. Yes?
Within a few examples where there's like a chmod plus x, does that add execute for everybody?
Question, does chmod plus x add execute for everybody? Yes. So you say you've seen chmod plus x, dot, dot, dot. This is the same as uo ugo plus x. Yes? Question, this is the adjusting permissions for the file foo? Yes, in both examples, file or directory foo. Other questions? Yeah.
Inside a directory, can files have different permissions?
Question, can files have different permissions than the directory that contains them? Absolutely. They can also have different owners, different user IDs, and group IDs associated with them too. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
For the last line, was so for the first example, OG equals X file or just file?
Question: should it be OG equals X or just OG or just file? So it's OG equals, and there's deliberately nothing there because if you look at the bits we have here, they're zero. So not the ones, twos, and fours place are all not set. So there's nothing to specify. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
What permission controls being able to move a file?
In order to move a file, you need to be able to write to the directory you're moving it from and write to the directory you're moving it to. And sometimes you might need to be able to read the file, but probably not always. Other questions? Okay. So, sorry.
I thought the second one should others execute things.
Yes, that's what I wrote an X. Maybe I should write it in a different color to make it clearer that that is a correction.
Oh, I mean, like on the bottom too.
Oh, yes. It should say execute here, yes. To be consistent. Other questions? Okay. So, we saw these sort of standard POSIX permissions here, and there's also sort of a more flexible idea of sort of general what are called access control lists. So here we had sort of a list of who can access the file, but it's a very limited list. We can specify one user ID that can access the file that also gets to change all these settings and whether they can rewrite or execute. We can specify one group ID, whether they can rewrite or execute, and what everyone else can do. And what we might want instead is a way to specify lots of groups and lots of users and different settings for all of them. Sort of this general idea is called access control lists, and some operating systems support them. So Windows usually supports these. The Windows file system called NTFS does it. And there's a version standardized by POSIX, which is, I guess, sometimes supported. So, and notably is supported on the department machines. And I guess I should say, not usually, but often not supported. So POSIX is like the Unix operating system standard. The chmod part, everyone who does Unix work does. This thing, some people do. And so some Linux installations will support it, some will not, for example. And in POSIX ACLs, we can basically specify the sort of config file-like thing specifying our settings for a file. We still specified read, write, execute, but we can kind of specify, you know, multiple groups, and for each of them, whether they can read, write, or execute. We can specify multiple users and whether they can read, write, or execute. And there's a rule that if we have settings for a user and settings for a group, the user settings take precedence. So if I single out user TJ1A as not being able to access the file, they still won't be able to access the file even if they're in one of those groups. And these would be settings we could apply to any file or directory. Questions? Yes. Sorry. Yes.
When would you use this over rigid?
When would I use this over the other version? So the main disadvantage of this is that it's not supported very as often. But otherwise, this is just more flexible, right? If I, with these settings, if I want to share a file between two people, I better have them be in the same group somehow. That's not something I can easily do. I need to make a new group for each that. With this version, I can just list every user. I can just add a row here that is user, foo, read, write, x, and now foo and MST3K both have access to the file. Does that answer your question? So this is just more flexible, but less well supported because, it's more to support. Some operating systems don't bother, having it all set up. Other questions? Okay. And sort of I show you the format here. The commands you use to manipulate this usually would be there's a command get FACL file access control list, stands for, and the set file access control list will add things to it. So you can add a line to it with dash M, remove a line with dash X, where I specify sort of the user or group, or there's also a default other line I want to remove. And you can also sort of add or remove where rather than taking, the thing you want to add as an argument, we'll take a file to read possibly multiple things to add from or multiple things to remove. Questions? Yeah.
What does the
M and X mean? So M is add to the list, add to this list. So we kind of conceptually have this configuration file associated with every file. And M is add a line, X is remove a line. Or with capital M and capital X, add a bunch of lines from a file, remove a bunch of lines from a file. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. So question, if TJ one way was in, say, the students group, would they be able to read the file? And the answer is no, because there's a rule in the way these access control lists are evaluated that user entries always take precedence over group entries. So basically the way it matches is it looks for a user entry that you match, and if you have that, it's not going to check further. Does that answer your question?
Is that also the same for rigid?
The more rigid state? Yes. But with the more rigid thing, because this user ID we specify here is the owner, it's keeping you from doing it as long as you don't run chmod. But you could run chmod to just change it. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What happens if you try to add a line about a user that's already in the file? I assume it replaces it, but I don't actually know. Yes?
What happens if the user is in two different groups?
What happens if the user is in two different groups? I'd have to look up the exact rules, but I believe they get the maximum permissions. Yeah?
How would you set the default?
How would you set the default? I believe you can have an other colon setting. So I think it's other RWX, which would be default. Everyone can rewrite an Xcube, for example. I'm not 100% sure, but there's documentation you can look up or the readings. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about how we specify permissions. Now let's talk about how that's enforced. And sort of the basic thing that happens is that on system call entry, we do these checks. So when you do open, rename, etc., we're going to look at these access control lists or these sort of simplified access control lists, compare them to the user ID and group ID of your process, and decide whether you're allowed to do things. There's also some similar checks on some other types of system calls. So for example, if you want to send a signal to another process, the operating system usually has this sort of fixed policy that you have to have the same user ID as that process. And if not, the system call will deny you. So this has to be done on the system call entry. We can't really do this at some other point. So let's talk about sort of why things work this way. And I realize I imported a question from when I taught OS, and we haven't talked about anything in option A here, so we're not going to talk about that one. But let's look at these other three options. So I'm telling you that the way things generally work is when the system call handler runs, it checks the user ID and the group ID versus the list and sees if it's okay, asking which of these alternatives would be a problem. So could we, instead of performing the check in the system call handler, could we perform it in the standard library? Right, we have the system call wrappers, could we do it there? Or could we do it there? So that's option C. Or maybe could we do it in the standard library in addition? Would that be okay? And right now, this user ID is kind of tracked in the process, you know, sort of OS memory, I should say. Memory. So the OS has to track this user ID for every process, so this extra information to track about the process. Could we avoid that by just having it be passed as a system call argument? So give you a few minutes to think about this. Which of these, you know, would be a security problem or would not be a security problem? Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks B? So let's instead of just checking, having the system call handler check, you know, if you're allowed to open the file, why don't we have the open function that calls that system call, like, also check it? Who thinks that would still be secure? Thinks that would be insecure? Okay, so I agree, that would still be secure. So this is okay, but wasteful. So we don't actually do this because usually that check's going to work out, So, you know, we're not really saving any time by doing it again to avoid making a system call. How about C? Doing them in the standard library instead of system call handlers. Who thinks this would still be secure? Thinks it would be insecure? Yes, and this is sort of the simplest reasoning why is that you can replace the standard library with your own code. You know, you can, you know, replace the standard library with your own version. So you could have your own version of the standard library's open function that makes a system call that doesn't do the check, and that would be really bad. How about D, making it, instead of having the kernel have to track this information, like all these user and group IDs, just pass it as an open argument. Thinks this would be secure? This would be insecure? Yes, so it would be insecure, and this is because, you know, you can write code that, you can, you know, write code to call the syscall. And your code doesn't have to pass the right version of that argument. Okay. So that's on sort of permissions on files and that we check them. Now there's some things we want to do which we want to talk about a mechanism for, which is one thing is like how does your program end up running as the correct user ID? Where is that done? And I mentioned that the kernel doesn't know about usernames. So the kernel definitely doesn't know about passwords to handle if it doesn't know about usernames even. So this is actually done by normal programs. But how do normal programs, you know, how are they allowed to access that thing? And the solution on a lot of OSs, including Unix-like OSs, is that we have a special user ID for programs that handle things like logging in. And this user ID on POSIX is user ID number 0, which is commonly called super user or root. Some non-Unix-like OSs have an equivalent, so Windows has a user called system that is similar, or an administrator is kind of similar. And the way things work is that there's some system calls that will only work for user ID 0. So like shutting the machine down, generally that will only work for user ID 0. And otherwise, user ID 0 is just set to bypass all permission checks. Basically, in the open call, there's a, if your user ID 0, don't even look at the access control list. Just say yes. And we can kind of view super user as kind of what for the OS, the same kind of thing kernel mode is for the hardware. Programs running as super user have this sort of extra set of operations they're allowed to do that where normal programs usually run in this restricted environment. But the programs are still running in user mode. The only difference is that system calls are just handled differently. Rather than system calls being very picky about are you the right user to do this, they aren't picky. So let's talk about logging in. So you log into a machine, type username, password, and then you get a shell. And what you're doing is you're typing into a program up here, which checks your password, and then changes user IDs, and runs a shell. And to check if the password's correct, it's going to use some sort of database that is going to be restricted to just user ID 0 accessing it. Because we can't let everyone read all sort of the password-related information, so we're going to have that be restricted in some way. And to change user IDs, there's going to be a system call that lets it change user IDs. But we're not just going to let anyone run that. That would be kind of bad, right? We don't want you to write a program that changes to my user ID and just runs whatever. We don't want to allow that. But since this login program is going to be running as that special user ID 0, it's going to be allowed to do this. But you aren't going to be able to run programs as user ID 0, so you won't be able to. And on Unix, the call for this is called set UID. You just pass a user ID. And How this works with login is that when the system boots, the first programs run as user ID 0, the super user, and those programs call setUID to run as whatever user actually logged in. So questions about sort of login and changing users? Okay. So one other thing that comes up is you may know about sudo. So some systems are configured such that if you're like an administrator user, you can type sudo in some operation that is usually restricted to super user, like restarting the machine. And you can type in your password, and somehow that operation runs as this super user. It runs with these extra permissions. So how does that work, right? Sudo is a program we're running, and because we're running it, it seems like it should run with our user ID. That's how all the normal programs we run work. So it shouldn't just be able to change to user ID 0 to be able to run this restart operation. So the way this is implemented on Unix is that there's this extra bit of metadata on executables called the set user ID bit. And when we run a program, the system call that runs a program, it will, as part of running the program, if the set user ID bit is set, it will change the user ID to that the user ID that owns the program. So with this idea, sudo is owned by root, mark set user ID. That means when we run it, it will end up running as root, not as us. And because it's running as root, as user ID 0, it can access the password database, and it can run that restart command with full privileges to actually restart. And the sudo idea kind of lets us set up ways to let normal users do things in a controlled way without modifying the OS. So for example, on a typical Linux, say, desktop machine, there's a lot of set user ID programs for common tasks we want normal users to do, but that require operations that are usually restricted to super user, that we don't want to allow any users to do except in a controlled way. So one example is mounting a USB stick. In order to do that, we need to manipulate sort of what disks are mounted. And the system calls for doing that sort of don't have the granularity to figure out the USB stick's okay, but changing the main hard disk isn't. So what we do instead is we have some program that handles that, that runs as super user, and hopefully it only lets you make good changes to make the USB stick there, not like change whether the hard drive is mounted. Hard drive is available. And we might do similar things for like controlling access to like devices. We might have a program that talks to a device that we normally don't allow normal programs to talk to. If we like a program that talks to the printer, you know, and does it in a way where we know it's not going to make the printer print too much or something like that. And some other things we might talk about later. Okay, so questions about this idea of set user ID programs. Sort of as this way of giving you, letting you run a specific thing as a more privileged user, but not letting you do anything as that user. Okay. So set user ID programs kind of seem like this nice elegant mechanism, but they're kind of often a trap. And they're a trap for sort of a class of problems known as privilege escalation, that normally when our program's running, we're supposed to be allowed to do a certain set of things. And it would be bad if there was some way we could kind of get around the set of things we're supposed to do. And set user ID programs are often a case where we can, actually, if the program has a bug. Because if there's a bug in that program that is able to do all these dangerous operations, we might be able to fool the program into doing some operations that it's not intended to do. So you may have learned about like buffer overflows in a prior course, or just logic errors in the program often will let us do things that we're not supposed to do. And as a kind of motivational example, let's say I want to make a program where I have a directory with a bunch of grates. I want to make a program that any user can run that's going to be set user ID that will print out their grate. And it's only going to print out their grade, so it should be OK. So here's my program. This program is incredibly insecure. Can someone give me one reason why? There are, in fact, like 15 reasons why. Yes?
Sprintf doesn't have a limit on
OK, so we have a buffer overflow here. And who knows what will happen after we corrupt memory from that? Something else? Someone who hasn't gone yet? There are a whole bunch of other problems. Yeah? It takes an argument. So you're saying it takes this argument, which is supposed to represent an assignment name. So what's wrong with that? So we could put a different assignment. There's a bigger problem, actually. But you're right to be suspicious about that. But there's a really big problem here. And the big problem is my assignment, which is named dot, dot, slash, dot, dot, slash, dot, dot, slash, secrets. You know, that assignment might be a problem. Because it's just going to make a path. I can put dot, dot, slash in a path to go to the parent directory, so it doesn't actually restrict to things in old grades. Yes? It doesn't have a... What doesn't have an argument? Argv, what? So, what doesn't have... I'm not sure what you're saying. Other... Yes? Oh, so you're saying we don't check argc. Yes, that's another problem, another out-of-bounds issue. It happens that the thing after the arguments is null, so it's not so bad, but yes. Anything else? Yeah?
We're getting B and write permissions, so they could modify that.
We're opening with write permissions, so we might worry about the file being modified. Yep, that is a thing which could happen, and the... Yes, and there might be, there's something to be suspicious about there. Yeah, and it turns out, like, the problem, where this would be a problem is that we could run this program without standard out open. And in that case, the first file we open would probably become standard out, and that would be a problem when we print it out. So that we'd edit the file in some weird way. So anything else? There's one big problem here, which is that I use this getenv call to get the username. And this is just a string from the program that called us. So getenv user, it's just a string that comes from the program that called us. It's not actually secure. It doesn't necessarily reflect the username. Like, when you log in, it's set. And usually you don't change it, but you can. It's not, but there is a, we have to use a different way to figure out what user ran us. Some questions? Here. And so the high level point I wanted to make is that writing programs that are secure in this kind of context is really, really hard. You aren't going to do it. In fact, sudo, which probably is like maintained by the people who have the most eyes on this sort of thing, has had bugs which allow arbitrary code execution because of, you know, these kind of nitpicky issues. And a big part of the problem is that when I run this program, I can run it in all sorts of weird ways. I can start with standard out closed. Does your program handle that? I can set up the signals in a weird way. I can change the path environment variable to decide what programs we run. I can run it with zero arguments. Argc equals zero. I mean, really zero arguments. I can set dynamic linker settings. I can do all sorts of things that are going to mess up your program. And sort of, we talked about these permissions in the context of like a multi-user system like Portal, but the same kind of things occur in other contexts. So like if we're thinking of a browser running a web page, we have the same type of problem, that that web page has access to all these functions of the browser, and the browser needs to ensure that that allows the intended set of operations and doesn't allow extra things. Like, you know, if we want you to display things on the screen, we don't want that to let you read what other programs are displaying on the screen, for example. If we're accessing a remote web application on the server, we don't want that web application to let us access files that aren't, you know, that we aren't supposed to have access to. If we're talking about like a mobile phones, you know about application permissions. It's the same kind of problem where the OS has decided the application belongs to certain permissions, which are kind of like user groups, and it should only, you know, if you aren't listed as being able to access location information, you shouldn't actually be able to do that. And we have this same kind of pattern where very subtle bugs in how we implement these sort of utility things can cause us to like not actually enforce these restrictions. Questions? That's where I'll probably finish up talking about sort of permissions. And so we're going to have a lab next week that's going to be mostly about sort of actually using permissions and those access control lists. Yes?
Can you go over what sudo does one more time?
Can I go over what sudo does? Sure. So sudo is this program that runs as root, and it's deciding based on, it lets you run commands with super user permissions, and I guess what I didn't say here, sort of based on a config file set by the sysadmin. So the sysadmin writes a config file saying these users should be able to allowed to run these commands as super user, and sudo lets them do that, often requiring them to like type in a password. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes.
Can you have the user be able to run some commands but not others?
Can you have a user be able to run some commands but not others? So if we think about how this mechanism works, as far as the kernel is concerned, it's just running a program as user ID 0. And that program has logic where it can have whatever if statements it likes to decide what it's going to do. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, why are group permissions necessary? So sort of a classic example, if you look at what groups I'm a part of, one of the groups I'm a part of is called CS faculty. So if I want to make a file that other faculty can read, group permissions are a way for me to do that without giving everyone permission to read that file. So commonly group permissions are used for cases like that where I have a group, like all faculty or all students or all people in a course that I want to be able to access a file in certain ways. Question, when they look at it, don't they have their own user permissions that will supersede the group? Okay, I see your confusion. So the user permissions overwrite, but you need to have a listing for your user. So either it needs to be the user ID for the simple permissions, or if we're using the access control list, your user needs to be listed here. If it's not listed here, the group permissions will apply. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, why is getENV insecure? So the environment variables, which I think you like used briefly for in CSO1, they are just strings that are passed from the program that ran you. There is nothing that restricts what can be in those strings.
So could I modify the user environment variable if I wanted to?
Question, could you modify the user environment variable if you wanted to? Absolutely. So if you type export user equals foo in your shell, and then run a command. That command, if it runs get env user, it will see foo. Other questions? Okay, so in our last 10 minutes, we're going to start our next big topic, which is going to be about going back to address spaces. So we mentioned we had this idea of address spaces, and we have these mappings from, mappings from program addresses to real addresses. So first, some vocabulary things. We're going to call the program addresses virtual addresses, and we're going to apply this mapping to every single address the program accesses. There are not going to be exceptions. So if we're reading code, we apply the mapping. If we're reading data, we apply the mapping. If we're accessing the stack, we apply the mapping. If we're accessing the heap, we apply the mapping. Everything goes through the mapping. We're going to call the addresses we get out of the mapping physical addresses. So those are going to be our vocab terms. And because we have this mapping in between them, it turns out that our virtual addresses and our physical addresses could have different sizes. And that's going to be fine. And we're going to talk about the strategy that's used to actually store this mapping, what format it is, where it's stored, we're going to introduce it today and go through it in detail over the next couple lectures. So I'm going to motivate this by giving an example of the same kind of scheme that's used on real processors, but with a toy example. So in this toy example, we have 10-bit addresses that the program uses. So these are the virtual addresses. And we're going to divide up the virtual addresses into four pieces. And I'm going to call these pieces pages. And I'm going to number them starting with 0. And it happens that I laid out this program, so it's kind of split up between the pages. So we call this first page, page 0, it has its code. The second page, page 1, has its data and the start of its heap. Page 2 here is expansion space for the heap, and page 3 is where its stack is. That's just how we've laid out the program. We could have done something different. But I've divided our addresses up into these pages, which are of a fixed size, and kind of evenly divide up the memory. And in this case, the pages are 2 to the 8 bytes. And I very deliberately chose a power of 2 size because that's going to make a lot of things more convenient. So we're always going to use a power of 2 size for these pieces. And because I used a power of 2 size, the first way that's going to make things a lot more convenient is that I can figure out what page something is in by looking at the upper bits of the address. Since my pages are 2 to the 8 bytes, if I drop the last 8 bits of the address, I get the page number. So if the upper 2 bits are 0, I'm in page 0. If they're 01, I'm in page 1. If they're 10, I'm in page 2, and so on. So this means that given any address, I can quickly look up which of these four pages it's in by just looking at the upper bits of the address. It's in hardware, it's basically free. Question?
So if you look at a assembly debugger of a C program, all the addresses in there are virtual addresses?
So if I look at debugger in a C program, all the addresses that you're seeing are virtual addresses? Yeah. As long as you're running on like a normal OS. Other questions? Yeah.
In the beginning, it talks about how the kernel and the OS would work together to provide the illusion that there is enough memory space, even if there's not enough physical memory. How does that work?
So the question is, we said that in the reading, we mentioned that this technique can be used to make the virtual memory look bigger than the actual physical memory is. How does that work? And we'll talk about that more later. But the summary is that we're going to assign each of these virtual pages to physical pages. And we don't have to assign all of them. And we can change which ones are assigned over time. Other questions? OK. So we have this page number. That's going to be the first bits of our address. We can retrieve it there. We're going to call the rest of the address, the part those lower bits, the page offset. So that says where in a page we are. So if I have page offset 10000000, that's going to be halfway in between, halfway in the middle of a page. So let's say, here's our program memory, divided up that way, and let's say our physical memory is twice as big. I'm going to divide my physical addresses, the real memory, up into pages of the exact same size. And I'm going to number them in the exact same way. And when I do that, again, I can use the upper bits of the addresses as the page number that I can, that if I see 001, I'm in page 1 by how I number these physical addresses, the real memory. And to run the program, what I'm going to do to set that mapping is the form that mapping is going to take is I'm going to assign each of the virtual pages to at most one of the physical pages. So I've said that when my program tries to access addresses between 00, all zeros, and 00, and a bunch of ones, it's going to go to this range of addresses here. This is what we called physical page 7. And when it tries to access 01 and something, it's going to go to, oh, sorry, it goes to, I can't read my arrows. So when it accesses 0, it goes to page 2. When it accesses 1, it, virtual page 1, it goes to physical page 7. And when it accesses virtual page 2, it's going to crash. Or it's not going to crash, but it's going to fail. It's going to trigger an exception. And when it accesses page 3, it's going to go to physical page 0. So that's what the OS would have chosen. Now, we can't present this information to the processor as a drawing. Processor doesn't have a way of inputting a drawing. So instead, we're going to have to fill in a table. So we'll have a table that will be filled in by the OS that's going to represent our mapping. And this table is called the page table. Yes?
The physical page number is arbitrary, right?
Question, the physical page number is arbitrary? So the physical page number we determine from the physical address. And that's important because we need to be very fast to figure out the physical address given a physical page number. Because what we're going to do in the processor is we're going to get this physical page number here and need to use that to construct the actual address to send to the memory. Does that answer your question?
I mean, like the mapping between the virtual address number and then the...
So the question is, the OS can put whatever it wants in here? Yes. Other questions? Yeah.
Why do we need virtual?
Why do we want virtual?
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of things that we're going to be able to do, but the biggest one is that we think of programs of having this layout. And there would be a bunch of problems of doing this if our programs didn't have this translation happening. So one problem is we'd be wasting all this space here, right? With this mapping, we don't need to do that. Those just aren't assigned to a physical page. Another problem is that if two programs think they have code at this address, well, we can't actually do that if they're loaded at the same time, if they're really using that address. But if we're using this mapping, that could correspond to two different things in the different programs. Does that answer your question? And we'll see some other motivations later, but I think those are the primary ones that we can kind of not have, we can have these empty spaces and we can have the programs have stuff wherever we want them and it doesn't have to really be there in physical memory. Okay, so where were we here? Okay, so what the processor is going to do is that we're going to take an address to do that. We're going to look up in this table the row of that table that corresponds to the page number we got from the virtual address, from the program address. And we're going to check this valid bit here. So in my table, I represented sort of had none, but we can't actually like represent none as a number. So to deal with that, we're going to add an extra bit saying if it's none or not, basically, which is going to be valid. And we're going to access the row in that table, and we're going to do two things. So one thing is we're going to check if the valid bit is 1, and if it's 0, we're going to trigger an exception. So that's your segfault. There's no mapping, trigger a segfault. If it's not, if it's 1, we're going to take this page number here, and use it to form the actual address. So remember, the physical page number was the upper bits, so we're going to use the page number we get out for the upper bits, and we're just going to copy the page offset, which was what, which was the how far into the page were we. Okay. So we're going to go through this more next time. I think I'm out of time, and I'll take questions up here.